do now is introduce you to John Johnson, who's going to come up here and introduce our speaker for the day. And just having had lunch with him, he's a pretty interesting chap, so this should be fun. Thank you.
It's my pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Stan Gerson. Stan is director of the Case Comprehensive Cancer Center in Cleveland, which coordinates all clinical trials, cancer research, and novel cancer treatments. And it was put together to harness the power of University Hospital, the Cleveland Clinic, and Case Western Reserve University. Prior to that, Stan was the director of University's Hospital's brand new 120-bed Seidman Cancer Center, which is a totally self-contained cancer hospital, only cancer patients, and the patient never has to leave the Seidman Center. Stan is also the president of the Association of American Cancer Institutes, which brings together 96 of the top cancer centers in the United States. There is little question that Stan is one of the nation's foremost experts on what is happening in cancer research in the United States today. Stan is a graduate of Harvard College, of Harvard Medical School. In his fourth year of medical school, Stan was assigned to Northern Labrador, where he served the indigenous people and the Eskimos. And while there, and very much outside of his specialty, Stan delivered a breech birth premature baby listening to instructions over a radio phone. Stan holds 19 patents, and three of his inventions are currently in phase two clinical trials. He has distinguished himself in a number of realms, including research in DNA repair, cancer drug discovery, and stem cell therapy. But to the people in Cleveland, Stan is known foremost as a mentor and educator for the next generation of compassionate clinicians and scientists in cancer research. So Stan, take the podium.
Thank you very much, John, for that unnecessarily kind and detailed introduction. I haven't thought about that delivery for a while, although I will tell you that my wife is an obstetrician, and she keeps telling me, "What do you know? You only did one delivery." So all of us get to deal with our spouses in different ways, and that one brings me down to size. I'm really delighted to be with all of you here today. I want to recognize and thank Dick, Ellie, of the organization for the Forum Club and the past presidents I met today for really running a remarkable organization that brings a remarkable amount of provocative dialogue here to Naples, and I assume I'll be as provocative as some of your other speakers. I also want to thank John and Ginny for inviting me down and having the audacity to think that I could match the qualities of many of your other speakers over the years. I know a couple of you are from Cleveland. I just met, Bruce Akers, who I will remind was my mayor for 20 years while I lived in Pepper Pike up in Cleveland. So I'm glad to be back and visiting with friends. So I'm here to talk about cancer. Cancer is not an easy topic, and I know that. There you go. Good, thank you. And I'm sure you do as well. No one who's had a family member or has gone through this by themselves is comfortable even thinking about the diagnosis of cancer, but something that I do every day, and I want to give you a little bit of context about cancer care in the state of Florida, up in Cleveland, and how it impacts our health care going forward. All this can be pretty overwhelming, and so my idea is to simplify and clarify with you for the next few minutes and bring forward for you some interesting topics which I think are very pertinent in today's age. So before I start further, I just to tell you a little bit about myself. John mentioned where I grew up and did my training. I mentioned my spouse, Debbie, who we met the first day of Harvard Medical School. I helped her bring her luggage up to the fourth floor of the dorm room, of course, that I knew where her room was. And she helped me pass more exams than I care to mention in detail. We then spent 6 years at the University of Pennsylvania after Harvard, and then came to Cleveland in 1983. And as you've heard, I've been the director of the Comprehensive Cancer Center for 14 years, and I'll tell you a little bit about that. We have three remarkable and delightful children, one of whom was able to join us here in Naples for a few days. My secret desire is that my spouse will get used to this place and maybe spend some more time here. Two are physicians. The oldest has two daughters, our grandchildren. She's a psychiatrist at NYU Bellevue, which is pertinent for today and this week, given the tragedies that happened just this past week in Florida. She works with these unstable and challenged young adults as they progress through adolescence and young adulthood, and knows full well the complexities of managing all of the issues that arise during development and psychiatric instability. The other is actually following in my footsteps. In fact, will take a position at the University of Pennsylvania as an assistant professor in a couple of months in hematology oncology. I don't know how he got there, but he's going to do great. He thought he was going to be a lawyer for a while, but now he's going to be a medical oncologist. And our youngest is a rocket scientist. Now, if you're a physician, having a child who's a rocket scientist is really good when you have to deal with the neurosurgeons. So our offspring keep us abreast of the issues of the day, as we'll hear from our high school students as well. I'm sure you feel the same way. It's our responsibility to make the world better for our children. So back to Cleveland. Herding cats and coordinating cancer care and cancer research throughout the city with university hospitals, the Cleveland Clinic, who are best friends until you're talking about a patient, in which case they're rivet rivals, and the coordination of a single university, Case Western. But putting that together is really a remarkable feat, and the powerhouse of those three organizations is nothing less than astonishing, both because of the research that we do, the oversight that we provide, and the coordination of care. So it's hard to believe, but within the region, the northern half of Ohio is 4.6 million people. Our organization takes care of almost 70% of the cancer cases in northern Ohio. If there's a treatment discovery that takes place at the Cleveland Clinic, it's shared with people at university hospitals. If something is discovered in the prevention mode at Case Western or an imaging study, it's shared very quickly across the whole region. It's remarkable what you can do with this coordination of efforts. Now, being an NCI-designated cancer center, as I will come back to in a few minutes, takes a remarkable responsibility and effort with oversight by the federal government. It's one of the areas, the National Institutes of Health, I think we'd agree, where there has been success in the value of the investment by the government. Now, the situation in the state of Florida is actually somewhat different. And those of you who have had your medical care here know full well that you can find an individual physician who's spectacular. You can get the care you need from an individual physician. But there isn't the coordination in any specialty across the state, and we think that that's a challenge. Now, as John mentioned, I'm the president for the next 2 years of the Association of American Cancer Institutes, which brings together the directors of all the major cancer centers in the country, and we coordinate efforts with them on improving care, on collaborating, on better communications, on clinical trials, on making sure that discoveries are shared. I have the Rolodex of all those directors. And if you need to have care anywhere in the country, I can talk to one of those directors and find the right doctor for you very quickly. So there's a huge amount of collaboration that takes place across these major centers that are coordinated and connected, and all of them have a research mission alongside their own efforts. But I'm also asked to advise on other cancer centers, and this past year, I've been to Gainesville, University of Florida, to Miami, University of the Sylvester Cancer Center at the University of Miami, and 2 weeks ago, I spent 2 days with the Moffitt Cancer Center up in Tampa. So I know the state's cancer centers. Moffitt is by far the most advanced. It has impressive programs in developing new drugs, in new immune therapies, remarkable outreach efforts to try to cut down the risks of cancer, especially in underserved populations, and special efforts in melanoma and in acute leukemia. Now, NCI is one of those, the Moffitt Cancer Center is one of those NCI-designated cancer centers, and has been so for the last 20 years. University of Florida and University of Miami are not. They're much more regional, located just within their region, take care of patients just within their region. But none of the centers have done much to really move out beyond their own location to provide patient care across the region the way that we've done so in Cleveland and Northern Ohio. Some of that has to do with the structure of medical care in the state of Ohio. And believe it or not, your legislature has understood this and has challenged University of Florida and University of Miami to become NCI-designated centers. That's why I've been visiting with them the last couple of years, to help them reach the standards of excellence that's required. And they're also putting money to work. They're spending about $20 million a year for each of those three centers to make sure they can move up the quality of their care. I specifically asked University of Florida to think about expanding their regional network so they can provide care to a broader number of people, because if they're going to have an impact, they have to see more patients. So why does it make a difference? So the 49 NCI-designated cancer centers undergo a very rigorous review by the federal government. It's peer review. It's under the auspices of the National Institutes of Health. But many of us leaders across the country go and inspect other centers. Both that helps with the collaboration issue as well as bringing the standards up to par. And we evaluate new treatments, new drug discoveries, new cell therapies, prevention measures. There are new treatment measures, for instance, for the diagnosis of Barrett's esophagus so that somebody doesn't develop esophageal cancer. A new blood test is being developed for ovarian cancer. Progress is being made, and we want each one of those 49 centers to make progress as quickly as possible and then to share it with other centers as well. Now, at our most recent review, we actually underwent a 5-month evaluation by the National Institutes of Health and came away with a score of exceptional, which is shared only by 6 or 7 other centers in the country, centers that you've heard of, Memorial, MD Anderson, St. Jude's, Dana-Farber, Fred Hutch Cancer Center in Seattle. So to meet the top echelon is not an easy prospect and something that we're incredibly proud of, and something that, as I said, I'd love to see more of the cancer centers in the state of Florida achieve. It's also the case that the National Institutes of Health gives away a huge amount of money to centers across the country to conduct research. Within the National Institutes of Health is the National Cancer Institute, and they provide over $5 billion, with a B, $5 billion of funding for research in cancer, whether that be for training the next generation, college medical students, postdoctoral fellows and the like, grants for specific discoveries and the like. More than 3/4 of that actually is condensed into those 49 cancer centers. So they really are powerhouses. And if one goes to Moffitt, you know that it's been carefully looked at and regulated. And if you go to your local cancer physician, who might be a great physician, he just doesn't have the backup that he would if he was associated with a major center. Now, I also know that in the state of Florida, that there are many of these major cancer centers that have little satellites here, whether it be the Cleveland Clinic, Mayo Clinic, and Memorial Sloan Kettering, so you can find your way to other cancer centers in the region to get your way through. Now, one of the things that we've been focusing on across our centers is make sure that they expand out their efforts across larger regional networks, such as what we've done in Cleveland. A few years ago, if you were living in Maryland and you wanted cancer care, you'd have to drive in to the inner city of Baltimore to go to Johns Hopkins. Now Johns Hopkins has 11 hospitals and network centers across D.C. and Maryland, and you can receive Johns Hopkins-level care in many different locations, which is really transformational. And eventually that'll reach the country as a whole and certainly the state of Florida. So why does it make a difference? Well, if you can coordinate this care, you can make more quickly an early diagnosis, have much more sophisticated options in terms of patient care, and to me the most important piece is rather than seeing a surgeon and then a medical oncologist and then a radiation oncologist, at the point of your diagnosis, all three of those people should be talking together because they work for the same organization and they have a standard that says this is our approach to medicine. And the big centers in the country do that, the smaller centers don't. But as we've been going across the country, we've also realized that this is a work in progress, that the data systems don't communicate. Those 11 centers around Baltimore for Johns Hopkins don't have the same electronic medical records. So we're not quite done, and it makes a huge difference in many, many different types of cancer where if you don't get the right treatment or the right diagnosis the first time, you may not have an opportunity for a good response. Many of us have experienced cancer. Many of you in the room have survived your experience with cancer, but you also know many individuals that haven't. The areas that we're focused on with the least amount of progress in the last decade, believe it or not, are adolescents, young adults with cancer, where the survival has not improved for 20 years, and likewise, pancreatic carcinomas, gliomas, and even melanomas. Of course, advanced cancers of any type, lung, breast, colon cancer, are still very difficult for us to cure. I became involved with Joe Biden after his son, Beau, passed away of a glioma, one of those very difficult to treat cancers, and after President Obama started the Cancer Moonshot Initiative and asked Joe Biden to take over it. So regardless of your politics, I think it's fair to say that Joe has made an effort, and certainly in the cancer community we know, to help improve our processes. He's not a cancer scientist, he's not a cancer physician, he's not a physician, but he had the right questions to ask. He said, okay, how about you guys come up with something that you can do that would take 5 years instead of 10 to improve? How do we get treatments farther into the community so they don't just stay in those ivory towers? How do we manage all this data? We know how to collect data. Why can't we use it for cancer research? How do we improve public-private partnerships and get rid of this separation, if you will, between the commercial sector and the academic sector? And what are we going to do about prices? So let me tell you a little bit about some of the activities that I've been involved with through the Biden Moonshot Initiative. Now, the Biden Cancer Initiative. There's been a core of about 20 of us from NCI-designated centers, a few medical informatics experts, certainly not my area of expertise, a few tech leaders from across the industry, including medical technology companies, Apple, and the like, patient advocates, one or two people from pharma, and some former National Cancer Institute leaders. One of the things that I learned in September, which I couldn't talk about because it was a closed meeting, I was sitting there with Joe Biden and a young man, happened to be my son's classmate, named Reed Jobs. And Joe and Reed were talking about Apple's interest in opening up your EMR to your cell phone. Now, this was announced formally, so now we can talk about it about 3 weeks ago. So if you had your electronic medical record on your cell phone, imagine what you could do with that information. You'd know your blood sugar from last week instead of having to call up your physician and ask. Not only that, if you switch hospitals, you can show them your medical record immediately. They could compare your scans and your magnetic resonance images and the like. But to me, even more importantly, is the opportunity that should you so decide, you could share it with a researcher. Because right now, researchers can't get access to your medical record because it's secured behind the walls of individual hospitals, and two hospitals can't even share it at all. So if we had access to our medical record, it would make a huge benefit to our health as well as moving along research much more quickly than we can today. Now, many of you have heard of a clinical trial. I'm going to rephrase that as a patient study. We don't exactly know how to treat you, so we're going to give you two options. We'll randomize. We'll give half of you one set of treatments and drugs, half of you a different set of treatment and drugs. We'll look 3 years later and see who did better. We've been doing that for a long time, and it's a requirement for any new treatment to get through the FDA. We have to be able to show safety and efficacy. And the only way to do it was to collect that information in a trial, research it, give it to the FDA, have them review it, and then the drug can be approved. Every drug that you take has gone through that process. But it's incredibly laborious. And in the cancer space, if we're developing a new drug, it takes us about a year to go through all the paperwork, all the regulatory issues to finally get the drug reviewed by the FDA and whoever the sponsor might be. And then we can open up the trial. So if you're a patient and you want access to that trial, no problem. You fly to Cleveland. You make an appointment. You pay for the appointment. You get evaluated. And then if you're lucky, you'll be allowed on the clinical trial. So with the FDA and the NCI, the National Cancer Institute, about 3 years ago, I said, guys, why are we sending the patient to the trial when we could be sending the trial to the patient? Why can't you be at home, visit your doctor, have your lab tests, et cetera, evaluated, submit that electronically, and if it looks like you're eligible, have all the information about the clinical trial electronically delivered to your physician so they can make sure everything is hunky-dory, and with Amazon, you can get the drug tomorrow. So slowly but surely, the Biden Cancer Initiative, the FDA, the NCI are starting to think about this concept of just-in-time trials. It would make it much easier to disseminate information about clinical trials anywhere in the country. On the other hand, maybe we're spending too much money on clinical trials. The cost of a new drug is somewhere between $600 million and $1 billion in the cancer space. It's remarkably difficult to get a drug approved by the FDA, because that's how much it costs for a pharmaceutical company to develop a drug and go through all those complex clinical trials. And it's why some drugs are $140,000 for acute leukemia. The new CAR T therapy that you've heard about recently in the New York Times is upwards of $400,000 a patient. It's unsustainable. So what are we going to do instead? Well, at lunch, I was talking with Dick about the explosion worldwide in our ability to collect data. We know how to collect data. Google knows how to collect data like you can't believe. If we had access to your electronic medical record through Apple or whatever, it would be very possible for a pharmaceutical company and the FDA to prove that a drug looks pretty good, we're not sure, but looks pretty good, let it on the market before those huge $100 million, $200 million clinical trials, collect data over the next 6 to 12 months, and know for sure that the drug was effective and useful within a year. It would shorten the time it takes to approve drugs. It would make it much more possible for all of us to receive new medications. And it would allow us to really understand what's happening across all of us. Most of us, when we do a clinical trial at a major cancer center, do so with a very carefully prescribed set of patients that all look the same, all act the same, so we can get really pure data to show this drug works versus the other. And then we get it approved, and it's given to everybody. So why don't we test it in everybody? So if we did that, if we allowed drugs to be on the market sooner and collected real-world data much more quickly, it would lessen the cost of developing the drug. So it ought to lessen the cost or the charge we would have for any drug at all. And it should cut costs of cancer care in half, which is one of the biggest challenges that we have in this country, is a huge cost of medical care. So it seems to me that that Apple idea could be far-reaching in the idea that it would give us much better access to all of our own collective medical information, both treatments and toxicities and the like. And I think that's going to move forward in the next few years as we amalgamate this ability to collect data and interpret it. It's also the case that I just didn't think of this myself. Last week, Flatiron, a major cancer data company, was purchased by Roche, a huge pharmaceutical company, because they realized this is coming down the pike and they needed the information technology available to them to move ahead. So I think this is going to come really at the marketplace if it doesn't happen through the FDA. Now, my last topic is the incredible value that's coming soon with the next generation of new cancer discoveries and the benefit that it'll have to cancer patients. So I'm not sure if I've met this bar yet, but I'm reminded of Chris Matthews' Hardball Roundtable, if you remember, where he used to end his show with a roundtable discussion, and each individual would have 30 seconds to, as he would say, tell me something I don't know. So here goes. So I'm going to mention five things which I think are new and hopefully exciting to all of you. So you've heard a little bit about the new immune therapies that are transforming some patients' cancers. We've had remarkable success in patients with melanoma, lung cancer, acute leukemia, people, and even lymphomas, people who could not respond to treatments before. So what's the basis of that? The basis is that as our cancers grow inside of us, our immune system gives up. Every day our immune system is fighting off bad cells and getting rid of them. That's why you're all here. On the rare occasion that a tumor grows beyond a certain size, it tricks our immune system, and our immune system shuts down and no longer fights against the cancer. So these new treatments are simply turning the immune system back on by overcoming that break and block in the immune response. We know how to do that a little bit. We're at the tip of the iceberg. But as we get farther along in this area, it really will be the case that more and more of us will be taking immune treatments to both prevent and to treat our cancers. It is remarkable how much progress has been made in that area in the past 5 years. The second relates to your microbiome. So you've all had lunch, and that microbiome in your gut is happily chewing up whatever you had. I'll remind you that you have as many microorganisms in and on you as you do cells, about 2 trillion of each, 2 trillion with a T. So it's just now that we're trying to understand how those bacteria and virus and other parasites that live with us, interact with us, both keep us healthy and make us sick. And in the cancer space, it's very clear that our microbiome affects our immune ability to fight off cancer and even to treat it when it's fully developed. That symbiosis will be better understood over the next few years. It's exciting research in the laboratories now. But soon we might be using those bacteria as treatment and even doing bacterial transplants of all things. Don't ask me how. You can imagine. But I think it'll become forward as a new treatment very soon. The third is our genetic code. We all know that we broke the genetic code 15 years ago. We thought we were done. But now, in the cancer space, we're realizing it's much, much more complicated. The genetics give us clues to how to actually treat every individual patient. And we're doing genetic analysis on most people's tumors now. And it affects treatment about 1 out of 4 times. In addition, we realize that families have clusters of cancer in them. And right now, only about 5 or 6% of the time can we actually figure out what the genetic abnormality is in that family. Recently, I had a very complex family, and I couldn't figure it out. And I sent them for regular routine genetic testing, and they couldn't figure it out. So we have an experimental approach, which is to sequence the entire genome of that individual and all of their tumors. And we found a mutation that was clearly causative of his cancer, his sister's cancer, his son's cancer, and his uncle's cancer, all in one family. So now we can go back and say, okay, what's that genetic defect, and how can we treat that, and how can we advise the rest of the family members? So we're rapidly realizing we can use our genetic code to understand our cancer and our cancer risk. The fourth is about age. Something that I suspect all of you think about every day. It's unfortunately the case that age is the major risk factor for most cancers, except for childhood leukemias. It's not that we want to get rid of age. We want to figure out how to handle it better. The simple advice I have, you've heard before, your mother probably taught you, balanced diet, sleep, exercise, and no tobacco. Those haven't changed, and please keep your eye on all four of them. But we're also realizing that as we age, in our deterioration, we can't fix our genetic code as well as we used to. In some special ways, our immune system falters. So those are two areas where we can now come up with treatments that will help improve our genetic system and our immune system to counteract the effect of aging. And I suspect that that will have a much greater effect on longevity than longevity pills ever will. We've also realized that about a third of us in this room carry new mutations in our blood that come from our blood stem cells in our bone marrow that are exactly the same mutations that we see in acute leukemia and myelodysplastic syndrome. And we've just figured out that those mutations allow people to die at unexpectedly high rates from heart disease. And the link is that those abnormal cells in our blood go to a plaque in our blood vessel and make the plaque much less stable. So a stem cell change that we acquire with age in our stem cells of our bone marrow affects our risk for cardiovascular disease. What we're going to do about that isn't exactly clear because we don't have treatments for those yet, but we certainly are at the point of diagnosing them, and you'll hear more about this as time goes on. It's called clonal hematopoiesis. Now, the final one is just on the edge because it was just come out in the last 2 years of research. And that is that inside those little pockets of tumors, as they develop, our nervous system finds its way into those individual tumor sites. And it's actually thought that the nervous system is encouraging those little tumor spots to grow. And that's why people who take beta blockers for their blood pressure or their heart, when we've done population studies, actually live longer with their cancers. Now, we don't give beta blockers for cancer yet, but maybe we should. But even more importantly is the concept that those nerves sitting in that tumor all connect back to your brain, which means your brain is hearing the tumor all the time, but we're not listening. And I'm pretty sure that very soon we'll be coming up with brain sensors that allow us to actually diagnose cancer because of these random nerves that are finding themselves inside our tumors. And we've just never looked and asked the question of what we can do about that in a way to either diagnose or treat a cancer. So like I said, five things that I didn't think you knew. Hopefully I've helped you get a better understanding of what you're seeing going on here in the state of Florida and around the country, and giving you something to think about for the rest of the day. My time is up. I've really appreciated the time to meet with you and talk about things on my mind about cancer, and I'll be delighted to take some questions. Thank you.
Needless to say, Stan, I have a heavy load of questions here. And we're going to start out with a student question first. What is the hardest part about being a cancer doc?
Well, by far the hardest part has to be not curing every patient, because half the time we don't. And so, in fact, it's very difficult to have those conversations. And I will tell you what I've learned is to be absolutely upfront with every patient with whom I have to have a tough conversation, so that the patient and their family become part of the process and are fully engaged in every decision along the way.
I have been raising money for cancer research since 1965. Why has it taken so long to find broad cures?
Right. So the first hint about a broad cure may actually be this whole field of immuno-oncology, because it violates everything else that we do in cancer, which is find exactly what's wrong with that particular cancer, whether it be a mutation or a protein or how it handles an enzyme. This is the first time where we've actually had the opportunity to look very broadly about how our bodies attack and manage cancer. Heretofore, we've always said that cancer is hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of different diseases, and the cancer phenotype essentially mutates all the time. So as soon as we look at its change, its change has changed again. So the reason we haven't been able to come up with a single cure is that there's thousands of different types of cancers. But as I said, the immune system may be the way to tickle underneath that and come up with a broad approach.
Is there data demonstrating significant differences in outcomes from NCI centers versus regional centers, and if so, what is that data?
I'm really glad I got asked that question. Unfortunately, I have to correct the grammar. It's R, the data. It's a plural, not a single, but okay. High school students, don't make that mistake. So the data are. So there are, in fact, many studies that have looked very carefully at diagnosis, treatment, and outcome. And in every instance, especially for advanced diseases, so adolescents and young adults with cancer do far better at an NCI-designated center than a community center. People with advanced disease, whether it be a pancreatic cancer needing a Whipple, a glioma needing combination therapy, many advanced forms of colon cancer, rectal cancer, where if you get cancer directly through an NCI center, your outcomes are far better. And those have been very carefully done studies.
Okay. This gets personal now.
Okay.
Do you own your patents, or does your institution own them?
Got it. So I'm at Case Western, so I'm a professor. And I do, in fact, have 19 patents. And all those patents are owned by the university. So they do all of the negotiation and whatever they're going to do with it. But what wasn't asked me is not about ownership, it's about benefits. And so certainly at Case Western, it varies across the country, but at Case Western, a professor receives half of the benefit that comes back, whatever those agreements are, of the funds that might flow back. I will tell you that those 19 patents have generated for me about $26,000 over 30 years. So, but the incentive is certainly there. Of course, the university also takes off all their patent costs, et cetera. But the incentive is there, and I have to tell you that it's important. My perspective: it's important for scientists to be thinking about the commercial value, because the only real way something's going to benefit the community is if it gets out either into the public sector or in the commercial sector.
With regional collaboration, electronic medical records, and health insurance companies housing and sharing data, how can ID theft and exploitation be avoided?
So I would think that it's similar to our daily interactions that we have with either Apple, Google, Netflix, Amazon. So the systems are good. They're never going to be good enough to be totally protective. If we ask our children about their sense of privacy versus our sense of privacy, we would realize that our children realize that they're out in the net and that's life. So I think in terms of identity of information, it's going to end up being shared. The real issue in my mind is identity and preservation of either an anonymity or financial and individual family protections, and those I think are works in progress. But to think that we shouldn't move ahead with information technology because we're working as we go ahead with security and privacy is a little bit nutty. They go hand in hand.
Okay, here comes one that I don't have the slightest idea what it is. How does a company like CRISPR fit into the medical community study of genes?
Got it. So CRISPR is this amazing technology in which a normal process that was first identified in plants and then was realized it could be stolen into those microbiomes and then into human cells aligns pieces of DNA right alongside our own DNA and cuts it. And if there's a little toggle, it can flip out one little strip of DNA with another strip of DNA perfectly. It's not so perfect yet. The Chinese think it's perfect enough for clinical trials, not in the US. But the company CRISPR, another company called Edit, are working very, very hard to treat simple genetic diseases. There's a single point mutation, i.e. a gene abnormality, for sickle cell disease. If CRISPR could flick out the wrong base and put in the right one, you could cure sickle cell disease. So that'd be pretty good. So people are working hard on that technology. So it is coming along. It's in that classic preclinical phase of making the methodology work, getting it good enough to impress the FDA, allowing a clinical trial to be done, and then moving it forward. So over the next 3 to 5 years, we're going to see CRISPR, this gene editing method, move in to the treatment of bad diseases.
Another student question. What are some specific problems that need to be overcome to get physicians in Southwest Florida to unite? Are they reluctant to create a network?
I wouldn't like to speak for individuals. I think in any walk of life, making it easy and reinforcing and benefiting usually works. I think the incentives aren't quite there. I think the economic structure in the state really allow and encourage individual practices, and there's things like certificate of need and the like that make it harder to amalgamate groups. The unifier, however, not necessarily for all of care, but for cancer, is NCI designation, because the halo around an NCI-designated center can be remarkable. And we have found up in Cleveland that people just migrate in. You don't even have to ask. So once the competency is there and the new technologies are there, people can often migrate in. But I think there has to be a recognition on the population side that it matters. And that's one of my messages for today. It matters.
How effective is IBM's Watson in cancer care?
Got it. So IBM Watson, you know, they're the guys who did the chess and the Jeopardy and all that stuff. So they've now spent, I don't know, $5-6 billion in healthcare collecting information from a few major medical centers, Cleveland Clinic, Memorial Sloan Kettering, MD Anderson. And they're trying to do better with that collective information than a physician can sitting in the office with you making a decision. And it's failed. The reason it's failed is it's not so easy. We're pretty smart. And I don't mean that in a bad way. We're all pretty smart. It's just that the decision-making process, when you have tons of different components of information, is really hard. And IBM Watson is still spending huge amounts of money, and they'll get there. They're just not there yet. But the deal is for them to have so much wealth of information that they could help with decision making and decision assistance. If you think about your own decisions, you need something else that's really good to change your mind. Same thing with physicians.
Okay, Stan, one last question from the students. As high schoolers, many of us are looking into the medical field and will be the future of the field. What advice could you give us as students that would support your vision of the future becoming a reality?
Well, you got to read, and you got to be on top of whatever is happening because the field changes dramatically. You got to be able to take risks and accumulate information that allows you to take risks on new approaches and new technologies. And you got to collaborate. So talking to your network is absolutely the right answer.
Stan, I would like to thank you very much. And we'd like to give you these two books. Thank you. And one is on Marco Island, one is on Naples. Give those to Deb. Tell her to read through them carefully, and you'll be down here.
Thank you
very much. And turn in your name tags.